Life of Jesus, a devotional study by Melva Perkis. Book 5, Chapter 12, Casting the First Stone. The rulers of Israel left the temple for the comfort of their own homes. The Messiah of Israel left the temple and climbed the slopes of Olivet to pray under the starry sky. How often Jesus did that! The familiar slopes that looked out over the temple had been sanctified by many nights of communion for the supreme dedication which was to be made when the hatred that seethed within those walls had exacted its price. Early in the morning, Jesus was once more in the temple. The people crowded to him, and he sat down to teach. Although the feast was now over, it is probable that many of the worshippers stayed in the city because of the presence of Jesus. The events of yesterday, though not dramatic, had created a situation of tension. There can be no doubt that the scribes and Pharisees were determined to apprehend him, awaiting only the smallest pretext. So far, their efforts had only brought humiliation upon themselves. But who could say when they would break through his defences and effect his arrest? The Pharisees had not learned their lesson. They were humbled but not discouraged. Determined to achieve their object, they did not hesitate to use a woman's shame to achieve their ends. The quiet scene in the courts was interrupted by a group of scribes and Pharisees dragging to him a terrified and dishevelled woman. Careless of her feelings, they sought only to make her the instrument of their enmity against him. "Master, this woman was taken in adultery, in the very act." Here was the irrefutable evidence. Now they could lay their snare. "Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what sayest thou?" It was a problem not without subtlety and danger. These men knew the attitude of Jesus towards publicans and sinners, and they were reasonably certain that he would not allow her to be stoned. This would immediately expose him to the accusation that he was deliberately refuting the law of Moses, an accusation which would only be partly mitigated by the fact that stoning was not now the general practice in such cases. In the remote event of his endorsing the law of Moses, their victory could be greater. He would incur the displeasure of the people for his inconsistency and the political charge that he was challenging the prerogative of Rome. Thus his enemies thought they had a strong case. At best, they would arrest him. And in any event, they would succeed in breaking the people's confidence in him. They had set the scene of this unhappy drama. They watched him now, triumph and hate shining in their eyes. The crowds pressed round breathlessly. The half-clothed, bare-headed woman, taut with shame, even greater than her fear, stood exposed to their hungry gaze. She dare not lift her eyes to this man whom the rulers had appointed to be her judge. She knew nothing of the plot that lay behind this last terrible hour. But her judge did not look at her. Entering into her feelings, his love spared her that. He bent forward from his sitting position and wrote in the dust. His action was a silent plea to the conscience of those men made heartless by their hatred. With an eloquence which no words could equal, he was telling them to leave the poor woman alone, to relieve him of the constraint of speaking. He gave them time to allow their own hearts to convict them. Had they gone away then, they would have been humbled. But it would be as nothing compared to the abasement to which Jesus was so loath to commit them. As was so often the case, they mistook his strength for weakness. They were blind to everything but his apparent indecision. They continued their demand, spurning the escape he had offered them. The moment came when there could be no evasion of the judgment for which they asked. The Lord stood up and searched the faces of these rulers of Israel who had stooped so low. His eyes burned with anger as he looked from one to the other. Never before had they so felt the stature and holiness of the man who stood before them. They became conscious that they were mean and graceless. Their assurance shriveled under his steady gaze, which seared into their souls, sparing none of the evil things now exposed there. They saw the enormity of their action. Then he spoke. "He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her." That was all he needed to say. He stooped and resumed his writing, waiting once more for their consciences to work. In the morning shadows of their temple, in full view of the expectant crowds, they looked strangely one at another until they could bear each other's glances no more. He had not accused any of them. He had left it to each one to decide. Jesus was taking no notice of them. He had no desire to be a witness of their humiliation. He was only grieved that it had become necessary. They watched his stooping form, conscious that at any moment he could stand up and challenge them, and they would have nothing to say. Silently each made the inevitable confession of his guilt. The eldest of them edged into the crowd and was lost to view. One by one, the others melted away until none was left. The woman could have gone too, but she stayed. Something bigger than her fear and her shame kept her near Jesus. He rose, and for the first time he looked her full in the face. "Woman, where are those thine accusers? Hath no man condemned thee?" "No man, Lord." She was not so distracted that she was blind to the reason for the slow departure of her accusers. Looking into the face of Jesus, strong, pure, heavenly, she saw the full degradation of her wilful passion. Surely there are tears of penitence in her eyes. "Neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more." Jesus did not condone her sin, did not even offer her forgiveness and peace. Sinners could not condemn her, neither would the one who was without sin. Jesus left it to her to merit forgiveness by her future conduct and faith. But he had given her a glimpse of the mercy and grace that were waiting for her appeal. Although we hear nothing more of her, we may hope that though she went away at his command, she would come back of her own free will, her desires sublimated, to join the little company of women who love much because they had been forgiven much. This incident has proved invaluable in Christian history. It is a graphic exposition of the Master's words on the Mount, "Judge not, that ye be not judged." However damning the evidence may be against our brother, if we pause and look into our own hearts, we shall go quietly away and leave him with his Lord. There are times when it becomes necessary to take action. But that action must not be taken because we have condemned our brother. It will be taken in the painful consciousness of our own unworthiness, and with a love which will plead intercession before the throne of grace. We shall wait with eagerness for the first signs of penitence, so that we can joyfully restore the erring one to the fellowship of the saints. Chapter 13. Thou hast seen him. Later the same day, Jesus stood up in the temple and proclaimed himself the light of the world. The claim was immediately repudiated by the Pharisees, and a verbal battle ensued which resulted in many of the people and even some of the rulers believing on him. But in most of them it was a superficial faith which failed to stand the test to which it was now exposed. The Jews resorted to the familiar claim that they were the children of Abraham. This would not do. Jesus observed, since, unlike them, Abraham had rejoiced to see his day. "Thou art not yet 50 years old," they cried, "and hast thou seen Abraham?" "Verily, verily, I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am." This dramatic assertion was altogether too much for them. Deeds, not words, could be the only answer to this apparent blasphemy. They took up stones, but Jesus moved away into a crowd that was not altogether hostile and left the temple. A thought of surpassing loveliness is often lost by the artificial break between the 8th and 9th chapters of John. If we link the two verses, it immediately becomes apparent. Following the dispute in the temple, the Jews took up stones to cast at Jesus. He went out of the temple, going through the midst of them, and so passed by. And as he passed by, he saw a man that was blind from his birth. Escaping from men intent upon his hurt, Jesus found the need of a man, a barrier he could not pass. Here is an epitome of his life. From the beginning of his ministry, this persecution had gone on, intensifying with the passing months, until it reached its terrible climax. But it never interrupted his gentle ministration of love, or dulled his ear to the cry of man. His enemies did not succeed in diverting him from his purpose. And by a sublime paradox, when at last they nailed him to the cross, he achieved his greatest victory in satisfying man's deepest need. The blind man was probably begging in the precincts of the temple. The knowledge that he was born blind indicates that he was a familiar figure there, and his history well known. The disciples, puzzled by the general belief in the close relationship between sin and suffering, asked Jesus whether this man had sinned or his parents. The Jews persisted in believing in this connection, in spite of the lesson of the book of Job. They took it to illogical lengths, so that when they found a man afflicted from birth, they were driven to the point of proclaiming it to be the result of prenatal sin. That there is an affinity between sin and suffering, and sometimes a direct connection, Jesus did not deny. But to assume that connection in every case by cruel scrutiny of the secret life of the sufferer was false in principle and morally wrong. Neither hath this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. Jesus refrained from discussing the subject, confining his attention to this man's need and his power to help. God's purpose was that his works should be manifest in this blind beggar, and that by his natural and spiritual sight he would be a witness to the light of the world. As the shadows of this day were lengthening, so the day of his own earthly life was drawing to its close. And with it would go those opportunities of loving service. I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. No more fitting work could be found for the light of the world than the opening of the eyes of the blind, unless it were the opening also of the eyes of his understanding. And such was his purpose now. The blind man was leaning against the wall of the temple. He had been crying out to passers-by for alms. Now, as the sound of footsteps stopped before him, he waited expectantly. The inconsiderate words of the disciples had little effect upon a man hardened by years of charity. But for the first time he heard the voice of Jesus. With the enhanced sensitiveness of the blind, he felt instantly the strength of the one who spoke. He had heard of the man from Galilee who was creating so much stir in the temple. The words he now listened to were beyond his comprehension, but he knew that this man intended to do something for him. Suddenly he felt his eyelids touched by strong, purposeful fingers. A damp heaviness pressed against them. Then that rich voice spoke again, but this time directly to him. "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam." Without hesitation he obeyed. He began his long journey through the narrow, crowded streets of the lower city. Reaching the end of the temple wall, his rapidly tapping stick would no longer find the familiar landmarks. He would lift his voice to cry, not for alms, but for guidance to those waters which would take away his blindness and bring him into a new world of light and beauty. Passers-by would look in astonishment at the man with a clay-spattered face, groping uncertainly, but with set purpose along the tortuous streets, calling with pathetic eagerness to be led to the pool of Siloam. Perhaps a friendly hand would take his arm and shorten his journey. At last he stood beside the waters, washing his eyes. In a breathless moment he looked out upon a world of movement and colour. The sounds and sensations of a lifetime took form and beauty. John says simply, "He went his way, therefore, and washed, and came, seeing." He would, no doubt, make his way through his new world to seek his benefactor. Unable to find him, he would joyfully hurry to behold for the first time his parents and his home. Neighbours looking upon this figure, so familiar, yet so changed by his radiant smile and his shining eyes, questioned his identity, only to be assured that he was indeed the man who sat and begged. The neighbours decided that their best course was to take him to the Pharisees. To them he answered simply, "He put clay upon my eyes, and I washed and do see." This stirred up that division among them that had been evident all day. There were those who dismissed the Lord's claims because he had broken the Sabbath, but there were others who reflected, "How can a man that is a sinner do such miracles?" But the hostility prevailed. The timidity on the side of conscience continued to the end, and only found full expression when there was left a lifeless body to wrap in grave clothes and place reverently in a tomb. The interview which followed is an example of the power of simple truth over perversity. The Pharisees were made to look ridiculous. Their only remedy to preserve their tattered dignity was to hurt the man Jesus had healed. The next question betrayed their confusion. What did he think of this benefactor? He is a prophet. Question and answer solved nothing. A moment ago they had appeared satisfied about the genuineness of the case. Now they reopened the matter by questioning the man's parents. This was futile. They confirmed that he was their son, and that he had been born blind. With the threat of excommunication hanging over them, they felt their announcement sufficiently bold. "He is of age, ask him. He shall speak for himself." They turned to him again. "Give God the praise. We know that this man is a sinner." He replied with sincere humility, but with none of his parents' fear, "Whether he be a sinner or no, I know not." But his words unconsciously turned to irony as he added this simple truth: "One thing I know, that whereas I was blind, now I see." The Pharisees had been driven back to their starting point. They asked him again how Jesus opened his eyes, but under this fatuous inquisition of the young man grew impatient. How they hated his benefactor! Their stubbornness was stimulating his faith in Jesus. "I have told you already, and you did not hear. Wherefore would you hear it again? Will ye also be his disciples?" His artless reply stung them to the quick. He could have said nothing more calculated to reduce them to impotent rage than the suggestion that they should be disciples of Jesus. But he had succeeded in turning their attack into defence. "Thou art his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. We know that God spake unto Moses. As for this fellow, we know not whence he is." Yet in appealing to Moses, they were appealing to one who proclaimed the coming of the greater prophet, to whom they must turn or be consumed. The restored man would know nothing of this, but their words had revealed to his quick brain a gaping hole in their reasoning. With growing confidence, the man who sees begins to instruct the blind. At first he had confessed that he knew not whether Jesus was a sinner. Now they had fully convinced him that he was not. "Why, herein is a marvellous thing, that ye know not from whence he is, and yet he hath opened mine eyes. Now we know that God heareth not sinners, but if any man be a worshipper of God and doeth his will, him he heareth. Since the world began, was it not heard that any man opened the eyes of one that was born blind? If this man were not of God, he could do nothing." This was altogether too much for the Pharisees. The interview had assumed a grotesque form. It could only have one ending if they were to salvage the slightest vestige of dignity. They still had the power to ruin him. "Thou wast altogether born in sins, and dost thou teach us?" And they cast him out. It is an age-old remedy. Not only would he no longer worship, but he was ostracized from society and would find all the doors of employment closed to him. Even those who engaged in conversation with him would be frowned upon. In view of the timidity of his parents, it is possible that he would be turned out from his own home. But the record does not end there. Such loyalty to Christ will always have the same glorious sequel. How many days of loneliness and persecution the young man endured, we do not know. But he was ready now for the complete enlightenment of spiritual vision. Jesus heard that he had been cast out, and he went in search of him. And when he had found him, he said unto him, "Dost thou believe in the Son of God?" The estranged man would immediately recognize that voice and know who stood before him. For the first time his eyes reverently searched the face of the one who had made him whole. His reply seems to sense the impending revelation and promised obedience. Who is he, Lord, that I might believe on him? With what loving appropriateness Jesus finally reveals himself by reminding him of the evidence which supports his claim. Thou hast seen him. And to remove the last shadow of doubt, it is he that talketh with thee. And so this poignant scene ended in the only possible way. John records it. Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. We cannot leave this dramatic incident without briefly suggesting its lessons. As we have seen, the signs of John's gospel contained the particular purpose of illustrating the great spiritual truths of Christ's work. This miracle set forth the claim that Jesus had made in the temple a few hours before. It showed him to be the light of the world. The blind man begging at the gate of the temple is a powerful symbol of the blindness and poverty of man, proclaiming his need at the gateway of heaven. The power to remove both, for the one is largely determined by the other, is revealed by the coming of the Son of Man. Our blind eyes are touched by the ointment prepared by the mingling of the dust of the ground with the moisture from the mouth of him who was sent from heaven. But this does not cure us. We receive the command to go and wash in the waters of apostleship. John is careful to point out that Siloam means sent. It is a long and difficult journey. Some do not undertake it at all. Some begin only to give it up and to resume their begging at the gate. Often it is made shorter and easier by the friendly guidance of one who can see. It is the responsibility of all enlightened ones to listen for the tapping of the stick and the cry to be directed to the waters of Siloam. But faith and obedience are rewarded. With the washing of the waters, we enter into a new world illuminated by the Sun of Righteousness. This may mean estrangement, persecution, and sacrifice. But it will also be an opportunity for witness and loyalty. Jesus will know. He will seek us out and invite us into fellowship so deep and abiding that all the former relationships are like the phantom sounds and movements of the dark world from which we have been delivered. For judgment I am come into this world, that they which see not might see, and they which see might be made blind.